You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll bring you the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Our agenda setter today is Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University. Hello, Oscar. What's caught your eye?
A story of grand theft austerity coming from Spain and two stories from Latin America, one of them involving the Pope.
Also, Icelanders head to the polls this weekend. Could this be one of the biggest political shake-ups in the country's history?
And in this week's preview of the menu, we head to Spain to talk gastronomy.
We are always searching a new product, new ways to discover something new to our people. And the Spanish gastronomy is one of the best, or the best.
Later, we'll be finding out what's got Aussies talking, and we'll also be reviewing the North American front pages.
All that, plus we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Oh, it's a little bit after 1 minute past eight in the morning here in London. Barney Burnham is here. He's going to start off today's Midori House with the world news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. US intelligence agencies believe Syria's government has probably used chemical weapons on a small scale. The White House said on Thursday night that the intelligence community had assessed with varying degrees of confidence that the chemical agent sarin was used by forces allied with President Bashar al-Assad. But it noted that what it called the chain of custody was not clear. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the city will always be a target for terrorists wanting to hurt Americans. He was speaking after revealing that the two men accused of carrying out last week's Boston Marathon bombings planned a second bomb attack on Times Square. Mr. Bloomberg said the surviving brother, Jokhar Tsarnaev, had made the claims while being questioned in hospital.
We don't know if we would have been able to stop the terrorists had they arrived here from Boston. We're just thankful that we didn't have to find out that answer. And as a result of the extraordinary work of the Watertown, Massachusetts Police Department, the Boston Police Department, and the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and other law enforcement agencies, the terrorists were stopped before they could carry out further attacks.
In Pakistan, five people have been killed and at least eight others injured in a powerful explosion outside one of the election offices of the Mutahida Qaumi movement, one of the strongest political parties in Karachi. The outlawed Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan has claimed responsibility for the attack. The TTP has repeatedly declared that democracy is un-Islamic and has issued threats of attacks on MQM, the Pakistan People's Party, and the Awami National Party, all of which are secular parties. This is the third attack on MQM in the run-up to the May the 11th general elections. President Obama has attended a memorial service for the victims of last week's explosion at a fertilizer plant in Texas. 14 people died and over 200 more were injured in the blast in the small town of West near Waco. The service was held in the campus of Baylor University in Waco. The president said towns like West represent the true spirit of America.
We need towns where if you don't know what your kids are up to, then chances are your neighbors do too, and they'll tell on those kids in a second. America needs towns that holds fundraisers to help folks pay the medical bills and then take the time to drop off a home-cooked meal because they know a family's under stress. America needs communities where there's always somebody to call if your car gets stuck or your house gets flooded. We need people who so love their neighbors as themselves that they're willing to lay down their lives for them. America needs towns like West.
Madrid's Reina Sofia Museum has unveiled one of the broadest ever retrospectives of the Spanish artist Salvador Dali. The exhibition features 200 works by the architect of Surrealism. It includes the famous painting The Persistence of Memory with melting pocket watches, which Dali said was inspired by watching camembert cheese liquefying in the sun. Jean-Hubert Martin, who was curator of the recent Dali exhibition at the Pompidou Centre in Paris, says visitors will be able to discover Dali in a broader perspective.
Of course, the core of the exhibition is really a wonderful selection of paintings coming from museums everywhere in the world. But we have added all these different fields like the cinema, where he was very active, together with Buñuel or with Hitchcock, with many other people.
Two rare bottles of Scotch whiskey salvaged from a cargo ship whose sinking inspired a famous book and film to be auctioned in Glasgow. The two bottles are among eight which were discovered in 1987 when a man from the Outer Hebrides explored the wreck of the SS Politician, which sank off Eriskay in 1941. 28,000 cases of malt whiskey were on board at the time. The incident inspired Compton Mackenzie's book Whiskey Galore, which became a classic British comedy film. The bottles are expected to go for at least £2,000 in a week-long online auction, with bids opening on Saturday. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Do you think we should pool our money together and maybe get one of those bottles?
I'll be up for it. I can contribute around £4. Phil, what have you got?
Flachty-machty-moo.
Yes.
You don't know what it means?
No. Sadly not, Barney.
It doesn't actually mean anything. It just came to me.
Gibberish from Barney. We will be back in 24 minutes with another check of the news headlines, this time, though, in English. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London, and it's time to set the day's agenda, as it always is, at about 7 minutes past eight in Midori House. This is the part of the show where we ask our expert contributors to choose the three big stories they think we need to know about in the next 24 hours.
And today we're joined by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer at London's Birkbeck University and a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Thanks very much for joining us here on the program, Oscar. Lovely to see you.
It's such a pleasure being here.
You've chosen three stories which you think we'll need to know.
Yes, they are stories about grand theft and failure to protect. One of them is about grand theft austerity. Kudos to Jello Biafra from Dead Kennedys for coining that term.
It's not yours, I note, although I was quite impressed with it when you came out with
really
the menu
good.
Earlier.
And the other two are about grand theft children, really harrowing stories. So let us begin with the first one.
Perfect. Yeah, let's start in Spain.
Spain's unemployment rate soared to a new record, according to figures released yesterday. 27.2% of the entire workforce in the first quarter of 2013. The figures underline Spain's struggle to emerge from an economic black hole that began 5 years ago. And now a big demonstration in Madrid is being planned against grand theft austerity measures. On Friday, Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy will apparently unveil even further fiscal and policy measures aimed at, as he says, halting recession in the Eurozone's fourth largest economy.
So he's clearly in very warming and increasingly hot political water. I mean, it is a record high, isn't it? Given that, and this is an unfortunate record for it to hold, unemployment hasn't been this high since the last days of Franco.
He says it all. I mean, presumably
the people, the protesters on the streets are going to be calling for change of sorts then.
You know, the funny thing is, yesterday a lot of people, a lot of foreign journalists were asking Spaniards why things have been so quiet so far. And many of them answered, well, think about the civil war. It was so terrible and the dictatorship was so crude that, of course, people were effectively pacified. But the same people were saying, well, now you will see things heating up.
And last night on the streets of Madrid, there were about 1,000 protesters in front of Parliament. They called for an indefinite siege of Parliament. And many of those protesters were obviously young Spaniards. And they have, I guess, a right to be on the streets there. Youth unemployment 56%. That's a startling figure.
That's astonishing. Should be cause for a scandal everywhere in the world. I mean, a third of the entire Spanish workforce will not find jobs. And more than half of younger population will not find jobs. So that's why we're witnessing two kinds of protests now. People in the street, but also, no less important, people just leaving the country.
I suppose the difficult thing is for the Spanish, the austerity story is being told for a few years now, and we saw yesterday new GDP figures from the UK, for example, which narrowly avoided a triple dip recession, but the graph was nevertheless going slightly upwards. So we're now getting differing austerity stories from various nations, and I suppose that comparison is pretty painful for the Spanish.
Absolutely, but the common trend in those stories is, the beginning of the year of low expectations. I mean, we're developing such low expectations that we're happy when an economy grows 0.3%.
Yeah.
She's, as Paxman put it yesterday to a member of the Tory party, not healthy at all.
And what's Rajoy's role in all this? You know, he took office in 2011, and you know, many expected him to really help restart the Spanish economy. But as we can see, that hasn't happened. How precarious is his position?
I may be too cynical here, and you'll have to forgive me, but Rajoy's role is to do what he's told by Central Europe. That's the role. But now, as the political situation heats up, we'll see what happens.
Interesting. Let's head over to your home continent and a couple of troubling stories about theft in the past, human theft, as you alluded to earlier on. Let's start in Argentina.
Harrowing stories. The first one is about mothers of Plaza de Mayo. Everyone, I'm sure, remembers these ladies who used to walk around Buenos Aires' Plaza de Mayo asking where their disappeared sons were. Well, they're still searching for them, and now they have turned to Pope Francis, asking him to open up the archives of the Vatican from 1976 to 1983 in order to trace hundreds of babies who were snatched from political prisoners. The group's leader, Stella de Carlotto, said the church must know where some of the children were taken. She met the Pope during a general audience at the Vatican, and Pope Francis promised he would do all he can.
And he was, of course, you know, when he was chosen as Pope, many people started coming out saying they were criticizing his perceived role or lack of role during this so-called dirty war when he was the Archbishop in Buenos Aires. Many people saying he didn't stand up for people. He didn't speak out against people that were taken as political prisoners. What's his role in all of this? And is this still an issue that is really bothering Argentinians?
Absolutely. And the whole of Latin America is a troublesome story because the church kind of played a duplicitous role at the time. On the one hand, many priests were out against these dictatorships. But at the same time, a great deal of the Catholic hierarchy were pretty much in support of the so-called anti-communist struggle. So that's why they have to walk this tightrope now. And Pope Francis is trying to do so by promising to open up the archives. The Argentinian bishops, in fact, issued an apology for the church's failures to protect its members during the military dictatorship. But now it's a question of trying to trace these, 400 or 500 children who were taken from their mothers and given to families of police members and military.
But presumably it's a little bit more complex than open the archives and everybody will be happy, because presumably not everybody will want to know a crystal clear picture of their own past.
That makes this story all the more harrowing. Of course, there are many of these children who have publicly said that they would rather not know their origins, especially if the information ends up implicating their adoptive parents.
And you've chosen another story, a fascinating story, actually, out of Colombia.
so fascinating that a film has been made about this story. Is the story of a peasant called José Crisanto Gómez, who yesterday was sentenced to 33 years in jail for having taken care of a baby handed to him by rebels from the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. This was the baby of Clara Rojas, a woman the FARC were holding hostage and who had given birth in captivity. Mr. Gomez says he wasn't a member of the FARC. He simply looked after the child for several months before handing him over to a state orphanage where he stayed until DNA tests revealed his identity. It was also revealed that the boy had been abused, a broken arm, never untreated, suffering from leishmaniasis and malaria. Terrible story. And Mr. Gomez and his family looked after the baby in a rural area in Colombia. Now he is fleeing from justice.
And presumably there is some concern over the severity and the sort of correctness of the punishment, given how complicated that backstory is.
It's very complicated, and in fact, in the first two instances, the courts had found Mr. Gomez innocent. Now that in the final decision, he has been found guilty. But clearly the backstory is still very murky. He keeps arguing that he wasn't a member, that he lived in a FARC-controlled area and he had to take care of this kid because, in fact, FARC threatened him. He also says that when he gave up the boy to the state agency, he received death threats from FARC, and now he's escaping. This is a really harrowing story. Everybody loses here.
Indeed, it is a fascinating story. Oscar, unfortunately, we have just run out of time, but we really appreciate you coming on. Midori House, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer at London's Birkbeck University, setting today's agenda.
Coming up, we'll head to Iceland to find out why the government there is probably about to get the boot.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, change is on the way to Iceland this weekend, or so the polls would have you believe. Anyway, a coalition between the Social Democrats and the Left Greens has been in charge since the aftermath of the economic crash 5 years ago. But latest figures suggest both parties' support has now slipped dramatically. So when Icelanders go into polling booths this weekend, they're expected to be in a distinctly anti-government frame of mind.
Much of the voters' dissatisfaction centres on how the mess of the financial crash has been so-called cleaned up and who's ended up doing most of the cleaning. So if Iceland is about to swing, what would the other end of the political spectrum mean for the island nation? Well, Sigrun Davidsdottir is a commentator for the Icelandic state broadcaster, and she joins us now on the line. Sigrun, is there a lot of excitement over this weekend's election?
Yes, there is. There's an absolute sort of febrile atmosphere. The reason is also that there are now 15 parties running. There are usually about four or six parties in parliament. So part of the attempt to renew things in Iceland has gone into those little parties. But having said that, they are actually not doing very well. The main stream seems to be heading for the old parties, and definitely, as you said, turning from the government, though actually these two parties are gaining the last few days. But the two parties which are mainly enjoying popularity is the Independence Party, which has been the ruling party since 1944 when Iceland gained independence, and the Progressive Party, which is a sort of a center party. The Independence Party is the Conservatives. So, yep, it's going towards these two parties.
Sigrun, clearly economics is going to be at the absolute top of every party's agenda. Give us an idea of how the different political parties are approaching this. Clearly, the ruling coalition put into place a sort of clean-up routine that there's been some anger over, at least how much of the responsibility for that clean-up fell on the sort of lower end of the socio-economic spectrum. So what have the other parties got planned?
Well, the weird thing is that although these two parties in government have turned the economy around, they have turned recession to growth, and unemployment is now diminishing and employment is gaining. But there is a lot of focus on private debt, on household debt. And also in this respect, the government has actually done a lot, but not apparently enough. But also the two parties, especially the Progressive Party, they have been very clever at peddling their own solutions, which are very much about distributing money, actually. People are probably starting to be a bit cautious about these promises, so they are actually turning from the Progressive Party. Now, the Independence Party has sort of been offering the same, but not quite as much. But then, as I say, the Independence Party has very much been the backbone of the political system here, and although people have been angry with them, then, you know, in testing times, people often turn to sort of the tried and tested parties.
And you mentioned those two parties, the Progressive Party being led by Sigmundur Gulluksson and the Independence Party leader Bjarni Bendiksen. They're essentially going to need to form some kind of a coalition. But it looks like the main hurdle towards any kind of a stable government could be the Progressive Party's so-called generous promises to write down the debt held by foreigners and try to use some of that money to cut household debt. Do we know how difficult it will be to create some kind of a stable coalition to run the government, how much of an issue this will be in terms of writing down debt which is being held by foreigners?
Well, you are absolutely correct that the Progressive Party has been advertising this solution. But this seems to be slightly losing ground. People don't quite believe that these promises can be carried out. In terms of forming a coalition, there will be a coalition. No party will gain majority, and that's also the norm here. There are coalitions. Yes, it does seem that the most likely prospect is a government with these two parties. But having said that, it's not quite certain, because if the Progressive Party would be the biggest party, other parties might be slightly unwilling to form government with them, especially for these very generous promises that have been made. So although some sort of a coalition with these two parties is probably the most likely, it could actually be led now by the Independence Party, which has been gaining ground. That might also make it easier for the Progressive Party to step down or to back down from their generous promises. But then, having said that, there could also be some other interesting possibility. So it's really difficult to say, which makes this a very interesting situation.
Sigrun, just briefly then, you said that traditionally it's a sort of four-party system. It's more like a 15-party election this time round. How much has that opening up of the polling booths shaken up the sort of political norms?
It seemed at the beginning of the campaign period that this would actually change a lot and it would give people a lot of possibilities. But as we know, as the closer it gets to election, there is more doubt about which of these parties will actually get people in. It seems that two of the new parties, one is sort of it's something that's been actually created out of the Social Democrats called Bright Future. It seems that they will get some, they might get the parliamentarians in, and also a very interesting party called the Pirate Party. Now, just the name kind of indicates that this is not your regular kind of political people. They are very much linked to freedom of information on the internet and so on, and they actually seem to be doing quite well. They are also coming out of another existing party. So these two might do well. So in the parliament, there might possibly be six parties.
Sigrun Davidsdottir, a commentator there for Icelandic State Broadcaster. Thanks very much for coming on Midori House. And we'll check back in with you on Monday as well to get the latest over this weekend's elections.
AM here in London. Now, the new issue of Monocle magazine hit all good newsstands, of course, and bookstores this week. And all week, we've been selecting stories from the latest issue.
And today, it's time to focus on the edit section. And joining us to speak about his piece on Auckland's Cocoa Cafe is Monocle's Simon Farrell Green. Welcome to Midori House, Simon. I just got to say, I've been having a flick through and looking at some of these pictures, and I've got to admit, I'm getting pretty hungry. I don't know about you, Dominic.
My stomach is rumbling. We'll talk about a couple of the recipes in a moment, Simon, if we can. But tell us first, what's so unique about this place?
Well, what's unique about them is that they're a coffee roaster who they've had cafes before, but for a long time they didn't. And they've brought their coffee roasting back inside the cafe. So you're sitting there, there's no screens, there's no hiding anything. They're roasting coffee there, and they're cooking everything in front of you. And it's all organic and all vegetarian as well, which is the other thing that they do.
And a good brunch place, I guess having a good brunch place is a bit like a religion over there in New Zealand, isn't it? Tell us about kind of that culture in New Zealand, how important it is, those rituals of going to, you know, your local cafe and having an amazing, you know, omelette or coffee.
Yeah, I mean, I think New Zealanders tend to, because we're at the bottom of the world, we tend to be quite extreme with things. So before sort of the late 80s or the early 90s, Auckland didn't really have much in the way of cafes, and then we sort of latched onto them in a big way. So brunch has become a major thing for the city. Most neighbourhoods will have a cafe, and people, you know, will go out for a big breakfast or whatever, and it's just a really lovely thing about the city that most places do a really great, you know, decent coffee and a plate of eggs. And I think it just sort of suits the vibe of the city as much as anything else. It is that kind of casual, you know, very relaxed kind of lifestyle-y sort of city, so it sort of works for that.
Simon, paint us a picture then of the vibe that we would find if we were to wander into this cafe this morning.
Into Kokoko, yeah. I mean, Kokoko, it's a really interesting one. It's in a former post office, so it's a 1940s post office, so it's a big concrete, solid sort of building. It doesn't actually have any windows onto the street, which is the really interesting thing, so when they turned it into a cafe, everyone was sort of a little bit funny about it, but it's got these very high windows, so you sort of walk in off a very busy street in a pretty sort of gentrifying area into, it's pretty self-contained, lots of lights sort of bouncing around, a lot of upcycled furniture, so everything that they could, they found either in, you know, demolition yards or eBay or that sort of thing. So it's got this really lovely sort of warm, quite, I guess, recycled sort of aesthetic. And and what's interesting about it is that the people that go there is a really big mix. So you might get kind of students, or you might get young professionals or freelancers. And the last time I was there, there was actually sort of, you know, a couple of old ladies sitting over a cup of tea. So it's that really kind of community feel, which is lovely.
Absolutely, Simon. I love this line in your piece. Loiterers in one corner, nursing hangovers, a business meeting in one, freelancers tapping away on their laptops in another, and then there was that old lady with a cup of tea. You've chosen two recipes for us. Just quickly tell us about the food that's here at Kokoa.
So Kokoko, it's all vegetarian, and everything that they make, as much as possible, they use artisan sort of growers and that sort of thing. So virtually everything on the menu you can trace back to a grower somewhere, and usually pretty close to the city. And that's something that's becoming really important to Aucklanders, because we can do that here. We can generally find veggies and produce that has come from a person that grew it, and we can find out who did that. So that's something they do, and everything's just very simple. So the two recipes we've got in there is the courgette fritters is the first one, and the other one is just a very simple plate of eggs.
Simon, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. I, for one, wouldn't be able to handle any more of this. We've got half an hour before I can get breakfast. It's unbelievable.
Starving.
I will be making some courgette fritters if I can just get me some chickpea flour. Not sure where I will be getting that in West London, but I'll try. Simon Farrell Green is Monocle's Auckland correspondent. Thanks very much. News is coming up in a moment. But before that, from New Zealand, this is Kimbra with a track called Cameo Lover.
That was Kimbra from New Zealand with a track called Cameo Lover. We're still talking about food, though, unfortunately.
We've
discovered that Barney is a bit of a chef, and his specialty is Indian, so we'll have to wait for that. But in the next half hour of the program, we will review the front pages with Monocle's Steve Bloomfield, and we'll also head to Spain to talk gastronomy.
We are always searching a new product, new ways to discover something new to our people, and the Spanish gastronomy is one of the best, or the best.
But here he is now, Midori House's head chef, Barney Burnham, is here with the news headlines.
That's gruel for you two. Thanks, Dom. US intelligence agencies believe Syria's government has probably used chemical weapons on a small scale. The White House says the US intelligence community is assessed with varying degrees of confidence that the chemical agent sarin was used by forces allied with President Bashar al-Assad. New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the city will always be a target for terrorists wanting to hurt Americans. He was speaking after revealing that the two men accused of carrying out last week's Boston Marathon bombings planned a second attack on Times Square. In Pakistan, five people have been killed and at least eight others injured in a powerful explosion outside one of the election offices of the Mutahida Qaumi movement, one of the strongest political parties in Karachi. The outlawed Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan has claimed responsibility. President Obama has attended a memorial service for the victims of last week's explosion at a fertilizer plant in Texas. 14 people died and over 200 more were injured in the blast in the small town of West near Waco. Madrid's Reina Sofia Museum has unveiled one of the broadest ever retrospectives of the Spanish artist Salvador Dali. The exhibition features 200 works by the architect of Surrealism. And two rare bottles of Scotch whiskey salvaged from a cargo ship whose sinking in 1941 inspired the famous book and film Whiskey Galore to be auctioned in Glasgow. They're expected to go for at least £2,000 in a week-long online auction, with the bids opening on Saturday. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. For this week's preview of the menu, we head to Spain, where a group of creative food entrepreneurs have devised a new initiative which hopes to revolutionize the traditional dinner party. The project is part of an offer from Spanish gastronomy club Sibaritus, which in this instance has united seven of Spain's top chefs, including Ferran Adrià and David Muñoz, and asked each of them to design a gastronomic mystery box which are then delivered directly to customers' doorsteps.
That does sound exciting, doesn't it? I know.
I can't take any more of this.
It's like whoever's producing this show clearly is trying to torture us. Unbelievable. Now, in keeping with their esteemed reputations, the chefs decided to get creative. But as our Liam Aldous discovered, they're still remaining tight-lipped about the exact contents of those mysterious black boxes. So how does a food business thrive when the entire concept is predicated on mystery? Well, we start now by talking with the company founder, Xavi Well. Inquisitive and adventurous food lovers, take note.
It's a private club to offer to our memberships new products and new experiences only with the gastronomy sector. No? We offer this kind of product that usually you can find at the shop, or the normal shop, and we want to discover, no, the local producers, local products, and discover this kind of product of Italy, France. No, we have a great gastronomy here in Europe, and we want to offer this simple, no, new products, and always with a high quality. You receive something that you don't buy it, no, and you need to eat, you need to drink, and every box includes a book and explain all the producers, all the topic of this month, etc. No? I think it's the perfect way to discover, no? Then someone choose for you.
So basically you receive the box and you receive instructions, but are they just ingredients to make a meal, or is it just different products, a variety of different products?
Sometimes you can make a meal, and sometimes you don't need to cook. No, it's all made, and it's only cheese, it's only panettone, it's only this kind of wine. We bring once sake, sweet sake from Japan, etc. No, it's not only for cooking, it's more for taste and to share. No, I think the gastronomy is the perfect way to share with the friends, with some people, and this is the perfect box. No? You receive at home something new.
I'm at the official launch of the Sybaret Mystery Box. Much of the commotion you can hear is coming from the chefs themselves, who are frantically preparing to unveil their own mystery box. In a way, it really does seem like a case of too many cooks in the kitchen. However, I managed to grab Andoni Luis Andorriz from the famed Magaritz restaurant in the Basque Country to see what he can tell me.
Some of the products that will go into our offering are two small conserves from Porta Moinhos, from Antonio Moinhos. There is a monkfish pate, and then there are the mussels, which are extraordinary, absolutely incredible. Also, of course, we have an Iberian pork loin from pigs, which are fed 6 pounds of acorn a day in La Dehesa, Extremadura. And then there's a surprise that I will unveil now, although I really shouldn't. We're also providing a documentary called Mugaritz Beseo, a creative documentary, showing off the food, the music, and even parts of our kitchen. But we wanted to include it in this project because besides being a very beautiful initiative, it evokes our philosophy. It shows off parts of the landscape which form a strong part of the products that we offer in this box.
You also have some very top chefs involved. How did you convince them to get involved with the project?
We are always searching a new product, new ways to discover something new to our people. And the Spanish gastronomy is one of the best, or the best. Our chefs, for me, are the new trendsetters, no? The people that have the possibility to have this kind of products, local products with a high quality. And well, we have this kind of product, the mystery box, and we meet up to Ferran Adrià, and we explain the project and, no, the possibilities to work together to aim the internet with the gastronomy, of this kind of gastronomy, and we have this kind of experiment this year. We convinced 7 chefs to do this experiment, no, for us at this moment.
Do you think that was key, getting Ferran Adrià to get involved, and then everyone else kind of got on board?
Well, a little bit. A little bit. All the chefs like this project, no? Because usually they only cook in the restaurants, and this have the opportunity to go inside at home of the people and have this connection.
I next talked to Salvador Brugues from renowned restaurant La Celler de Can Roca in Girona about his mystery box.
We have made a fun mystery box that basically tries to play around with two of your senses. The idea is primarily based around having fun and teaching people, and to enjoy yourself.
While Salvador wasn't keen to give any secrets away, I managed to corner rock star chef David Munoz, who was a little more forthcoming.
We got a box that is quite different. I like to say our chef box is going to be like the rock and roll. So it's going to be powerful, spicy, hot, and crazy. It's going to be a box that is will be traveling around the world with chili, with a lot of chili. We cannot say anymore. For sure, like I told you, it's going to be a box that is traveling around the world. Will be some different ingredients from different parts of the world. And we will show to the people how to use these different ingredients from, for example, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, how to use them in a different way, in a Spanish way, in a Mediterranean way. So I think it's going to be everything about fun.
The last chef I speak to is Kike da Costa from the Mediterranean city Alicante. He too is coy about revealing all, but still attempts to explain how his past inspirations as a chef inspired him to design his mystery box.
My main goal when deciding the insides of the box, which as you know is a secret, was to try and reflect one of the icons of my restaurant in Denia. Apart from that, I think we have tried to include anything that fits in a box, which reflects the soul of the Mediterranean and the soul of the Valencian community. I'm sure that the people who know us will well be able to guess the main feature of our particular mystery box. In the end, we've used something which unites cultures around the world and is present in every country in some shape or form.
I'll leave those of you at home to solve that gastronomic riddle. For the time being, I'm going to enjoy this rare opportunity to peer inside all seven mystery boxes. I could go on to tell you about the interactive game which tantalizes the senses, but that would ruin the surprise and the fun. And so for now, for Monocle, in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
And he was talking to Xavi Guel, founder of the Spanish gastronomy club Siboritus.
What would you put in your gastronomy mystery box?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Phil, and I'm glad you asked. I'm partial to a delicious omelette, actually. I'm an omelette man.
I love omelettes as well. What's your favorite?
It's the basis through which you can create, you know.
Anything.
You can have
an omelette as a dinner meal as well.
Precisely.
Right? Well, put in the oven, there's a frittata.
Well, with mine, you definitely could.
Okay.
I mean, omelette is actually doing it down. It's a higher class of food than that, I would say.
Okay.
I know, you're hungry.
I'm very hungry.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're hungry as well.
What's in yours?
I think I'd have a bit of a mix, maybe a bit of kimchi in there.
Oh, okay.
For my heritage.
Yeah.
maybe a bit of pasta, a bit of risotto maybe.
Yeah.
I'm a big risotto fan.
Okay.
So kind of everything.
So you're mishmash. You're having a sort of global smorgasbord.
International buffet, yes.
In a box.
You are listening to Midori House with a very hungry Dominic Reynolds and Phil Hahn. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our man in Melbourne, Patrick Pittman.
House Vision in Tokyo is an exhibition that combines the wisdom of Japan's best creative thinkers with state-of-the-art technology. Curated by the visionary designer Kenyahara, the mission was to explore new and unconventional ways of urban living.
Japan's post-war growth spurt might have brought wealth, but one of the great ironies is that despite rising incomes, most Japanese live in homes that are cramped and uniformly bland. For all the expert craftsmanship that goes into building homes here, rarely do they last more than a generation.
House Vision, a future perfect film from Tokyo on Monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:43 here in London, and it is 17:43 in Melbourne, where we're going to head next.
Indeed. Joining us on the line now is Monocle's correspondent in that very city. It's Patrick Pittman. Welcome back to Midori House, Patrick. How are you?
Good. It's getting close to dinner time here.
just when I thought we were going to be able to spend 5 minutes not talking about food. Let's try and do that from now on, Patrick. And we'll start with the WikiLeaks party and their apparent polling success.
It's an interesting one. The WikiLeaks party announced that they were going to campaign in this year's federal election for the Senate about a month or so ago. And there's been a few polls, well, one poll in particular that's come out that actually shows that maybe they're actually going to get a little bit of support.
And this is a big surprise. Presumably, such a young party with such an apparent one-issue stance wasn't expected to make much of an impact.
I mean, they were always going to be part of the debate in the election, but I don't think people were necessarily expecting these numbers so quickly. They do claim they've got 1,000 members to date as well. It should be kept in mind that this isn't necessarily one of the major polls that people would look at closely, and they're not going to end up with the 26% of votes that these polls are saying, but they will be there.
And what about the man perhaps in charge of that party, Julian Assange? He's announced his intention to actually run for a seat in Parliament?
Yes, so he's going to be running in the Victorian Senate, is what he said. He hasn't officially nominated, as I understand, but he says he will be running in exile. It remains to be seen what would happen if he actually won the seat, which is its possibility.
Talk to us about how Australians view him, because he has almost this reputation as sort of an international human being, but he is an Australian still, although he's been hiding out in another nation's embassy in London for some time. Is there pride, confusion, dislike? How do the Australians feel about him?
I think all of the above. Like anybody else, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out exactly who Julian Assange is and what he stands for. There's a lot of support for him. He comes from Melbourne, where I'm speaking to you from, and there is a strong movement here. The WikiLeaks were closely associated with the Age newspaper here in Melbourne as well. So, you know, there is a connection to it, but again, there's a lot of distrust from others and a lot of criticism as well. So pretty much the same as everywhere else.
And Patrick, another story that you've highlighted is the continuing political situation on the very small island of Nauru. What can you tell us about that?
It's a strange series of events going on in Nauru. Now, that's the country, it's the smallest republic in the world. They have an 18-member parliament, which apparently is currently split into at least 6 factions, as I understand. They have massive unemployment. They're currently hosting one of Australia's offshore detention centres. Now, the government dissolved in March after the president, Brent de Guido, faced a vote of no confidence. He dissolved the parliament, tried to call an election. That election was then overturned by the Supreme Court because it wasn't validly called. And since then, the parliament hasn't been able to get a quorum to sit again to call a new election, mostly because half of the members have been overseas.
The world's smallest republic, then, and I should point out that this is the subject of your latest brief in the magazine, I believe. It is the world's smallest republic, but obviously enormous connections to the Australian mainland, particularly in the responsibility it has for processing refugees. So, how much of a storm is this causing on the mainland about these sort of absurdities, as you say, of the political system there?
These absurdities aren't probably getting as much attention as the ongoing court cases against the actual detention centres. People are getting concerned because the government on Nauru are responsible for processing these asylum seekers, and there doesn't appear to be an actual government at this time. There is a fair amount of concern going on, but more of the attention is being focused on the court cases that are actually being brought about to challenge the validity of the detention centre where the asylum seekers are being kept.
And Patrick, your colleagues across the pond, so to speak, across the Tasman Sea over in New Zealand, were celebrating the legalization of same-sex marriage. Is that something that is getting a bit of traction there in Australia?
It is, and surprisingly so. Obviously, what happened in New Zealand last week caught world attention with that beautiful song and Maurice Williamson's speech about the gay rainbow in his electorate. It's actually surprisingly the conservative leaders in Australia that seem to be taking a bit of a stand on this as well. This week, New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell came out and said that he would support a vote for same-sex marriage in his state, but is pushing the conservative opposition leader Tony Abbott to allow a conscience vote should he take government in September. And it's those conservative leaders that are pushing this thing. So that's unexpected, but there seems to be momentum.
And Tony Abbott, a well-known and well-publicised views, perhaps on the more extreme end of the spectrum on social issues. This is obviously a touchstone social issue. Which side of the debate has he come down on?
Well, I think a lot of people didn't see this one coming, but he has actually dropped a few hints this week. He hasn't said anything concrete, but he has been vaguely hinting that he may allow a conscience vote for his members after the federal election, should they end up taking the leadership.
Patrick, that's all the time we have for now. I'll let you head off and enjoy your dinner on a Friday night in Melbourne. We'll be thinking of you, and our tummies will be rumbling.
You couldn't just not talk about food for a couple of minutes.
It was on my mind.
Bizarre.
Patrick Pittman, live from Melbourne. Thanks very much. And you are listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Time now to welcome Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to the studio to review the European front pages. Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm very good
indeed.
Happy
Friday.
Happy Friday to you too. You've been talking about food all day.
Weirdly, I don't know why. Phil keeps bringing it back. What's your favourite recipe?
Well, in fact, can I give you some... it's a bit wrong to call this food-related news. Animal-related news from here at Midori House.
Slightly concerning.
There are three ducks outside.
Oh.
And one of them has just laid an egg.
No.
Genuinely.
See,
just outside.
Lots of people would see a lovely act of nature. You see it as food-related news.
So should we get that egg and crack it open?
I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. I mean, it's a little bit worrying. It's, you know, they've just abandoned the egg because they're not quite sure what to do. Anyway.
Urban ducks, the tragedy, eh?
Yes. Breaking news. Hopefully not actually breaking there. From outside Midori House. I've got a brilliant story from Australia, which I'm going to end on.
Okay, we'll save that.
And we're also going to start in the US. Yesterday, obviously, it was the inauguration of the George W. Bush Presidential Library. Lots of stuff in the papers today. I particularly liked, there was one cartoon I saw today of what seemed to be a combination of a fountain and waterboarding, with someone saying, "Oh, I love the fountain." Sadly, that's not actually at the library itself. But there's obviously this coverage all over the place. And there's a nice piece by Peter Baker in the New York Times talking about, the presidents all together, because obviously Bill Clinton was there, George H.W. Bush was there, and obviously Barack Obama as well. And the story, "For Bush, a day to bask in Texas sun." It's all very nice, it's all very lovely. And then inside, the New York Times gives it both barrels. The editorial is "The Guantanamo Stain," pointing out some of the things in the Bush legacy which are perhaps not mentioned in quite the same way.
And he was brought to tears, wasn't he, yesterday when he was at this ceremony. For our listeners outside of the U.S., this is a commonplace thing. Former presidents open up their own presidential libraries. Do we know what's in this library yet?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is he has, he's wanted to do his library. Yeah, he talks about how he was the decider, and his book was called Decision Points. All about, look, these are the decisions I had to make, and if you were in my shoes, you would have done the same thing. And so part of what he's doing at the library is saying, well, look, let's look at some of the decisions I took. What would you have done, facing this great recession? How would you have decided to deal with this? What would you have done if Osama bin Laden attacked and the Taliban were hosting him? What would you have done? What he doesn't do, which I think would be quite good, is show the videos, which the CIA have, of torture or enhanced interrogation techniques, as he called them.
Yes, very good.
Why don't we show them and see whether people think they're torture?
Interesting. There's a suggestion, a challenge out there.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, but there we are.
Perhaps in the Memorial Library he will at last, in Texas, get an answer to the question from 2003, is our children learning?
Indeed, indeed.
What else have you got
for us,
Steve?
The problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur. Sometimes, I miss him. Sometimes
so
I miss
good,
him.
For stuff like that, absolutely.
Front of the Financial Times... picture of Angela Merkel. "Merkel austerity comments highlights Eurozone division on interest rates." We've had in the last few days lots of European leaders saying, "Ooh, this austerity stuff, maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all." Angela Merkel yesterday said, "It used to just be called budget consolidation or solid economising. Now it's called austerity, which sounds as if some sort of enemy is coming after us." She's trying to say, look, there's nothing wrong with this. This is just,
sound money, sound economics. She's talking nonsense.
Sound German economics, certainly.
Yes, exactly. Fine for her, not necessarily fine for the rest of Europe. And then, frankly, if it's not very good for the rest of Europe, then it won't be very good for her either. How much long do we have?
Because I need time for just one more story.
I think we need to talk about the final story, yeah.
Okay.
Let's not miss this out.
This is from the Morning Bulletin, which, as you know, is the only newspaper the residents of Rockhampton in Queensland read.
Of course.
Correction. There was an error printed in a story titled Pigs Float Down the Dawson on page 11 of yesterday's Bully. Obviously, they call the Morning Bulletin the Bully.
Everything's got an IE on the end, hasn't
the
it?
The story by reporter Daniel Burden, and I must say, I think naming the and shaming the reporter is a little bit off, but anyway. The story by Daniel Burden said more than 30,000 pigs were floating down the Dawson River. 30,000. What piggery owner Sid Everingham actually said was 30 sows and pigs. Now, I have two thoughts on this.
Really?
Okay, well, I have one. Yeah, obviously, a bit of a mistake there.
Yeah.
But more to the point, who was the editor of this paper who thought 30,000 pigs floating down a river? I know, I'll stick it on page 11.
Exactly. And how much news goes on in Rockhampton in Queensland on a regular basis that isn't trumpeted around the newsroom? Guys!
30,000 pigs!
At least surely they would have sent the young snapper down there to take a few shots of that?
You'd think so. Anyway, poor Daniel Burden. It's an easy mistake to make. I might have heard that as 30,000 pigs, not 30,000 pigs.
Monocle's foreign editor there with the news that you will need to know for the coming day, setting our agenda. That was Steve Bloomfield, of course.
And I'm sure Steve would say that was food-based news at the end of that as well.
Bacon. Oh, yeah, it was. That actually was food-based news.
There we
news.
Go. That has been your food-based Bizarrely at Midori House today, and it's all we have time for. Thanks to our outgoing producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager, the man, Jack Phillips. Now, up next after the news is this week's episode of Section D with Hugo McDonald Blutt to play us and Dawn out of this Friday edition of Midori House. This is Losing You by Solange.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.